This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, that's a sound that's probably familiar to many of you, kids at a playground. Except that this isn't like a regular playground with plastic slides, rubberized floor coverings, and toddler-safe swings.
At the Spark Center in Mattapan, kids do things like...
I'm playing in the sand.
And...
This is the way we clap our wood.
And they use big wooden blocks to make spontaneous music.
The way we clap our wood early in the morning.
They basically get wet, dirty, creative, and happy.
Everything here is built out of stones and logs and earth and sand and water and grass. They can roll down the hill, or they can sit on the logs, or they can climb up the stepping stones and onto the boulders.
Local architect Tamar Warburg helped design this natural playground at the Spark Center. She was on Radio Boston back in 2010. And since then, these alternative playground designs have grown in popularity all around Boston.
And in fact, natural playgrounds with their wood, water, and grass have less in common with the primary colored plastics of the 1990s and more in common with the nation's first playgrounds, which sprung up in Boston in the 1890s. And child development experts say in our high-calorie, sedentary, safety-obsessed, device-addicted present, having playgrounds that harken back to a healthier past is a great thing for kids. We're going to dig in more now to this idea of natural playgrounds with Ruth Graham, who wrote about the issue recently in the Boston Globe with a piece called How the American Playground Was Born in Boston. She joins us today from Concord, New Hampshire. Ruth, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
It's great to be talking to you on what's a sunny day in Greater Boston, so hopefully a lot of kids are playing outside. Also with us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma, is Paige Johnson. She's a Tulsa-based playground expert and is curating an exhibit on playground design for the Boston Design Museum that will open next year. Paige, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk in a few minutes about these sort of the new wave of natural and less structured playgrounds. But Ruth, I wanted to start with you and take us back to this fascinating history about how the nation's first playground sprung up in Boston. Where and what were they like?
Yeah, it's a great story. It goes back to the 1880s, and there's this German-born Bostonian doctor who founded a women's hospital, Maria Zakchevska, and she's on a trip to Berlin and saw that they had installed a couple of these big sand piles there. And there's, at the time, in the 19th century, a lot of sort of progressive child development ideas are coming out of Germany. So she writes a letter back to the Massachusetts Hygiene and Emergency Commission, which sounds sort of like a utility or something, but was a philanthropic organization, and said, you've got to try this in Boston. There's rich kids playing with poor kids, and it's this kind of idyllic setup. So they try it out. In the summer of 1885, they dump a pile of sand in a chapel in the North End. And kids come there, I think it's on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, and there's a matron who looks after them, and they have their little wheelbarrows, and they're digging, and it's a huge hit. So,
well, in fact, you write that it's this pile of sand in the North End is such a huge hit that even, I think you write that older kids bring their younger siblings along just so that they can get in?
Exactly. That's a couple of years later, but exactly. So there is kind of an admittance policy with only younger kids, you know, that let the babies play in the sand, and so these older boys come back and say, you know, they come back toting neighbors and siblings and saying, okay, you know, can we get in now? So, yeah, they're a huge hit with kids of all ages. So
Paige, jump in here because I'm curious. I mean, honestly, anyone who is familiar with the playing habits of a toddler might understand the attraction of just a pile of sand. It can go a long way. But what was it about something as simple as that in the late 1880s, early 1890s, that did prove such a hit? Because I guess, you know, one might imagine that kids may have had more freedom to just explore the city at that time.
Right. It seems quite obvious, but we have to remember that at that time, there really wasn't much thought given to design for children, and particularly not in the urban space. So it was a dedicated space for children to come and interact with each other and really stay all day unsupervised. It was really the only option that they had. And there certainly was in that history an element of kind of philanthropic social control, as we often see in public parts, this idea that having the children in the sand pile is way better than having them on the streets. but certainly it was something that the children loved. And then the playground kind of grows naturally out of that. Once you have the sand pile and all these kids gathered in one spot, it becomes natural to say, okay, hey, let's add a swing. you know, maybe we should add some ladders that the kids can climb on. And at this point in time, there's a concern about kind of physical fitness, and you're seeing objects from the gymnasium essentially get dragged outside.
Right.
And this is really the birth of the idea of equipment on the playground, of things that are actually dedicated to play. And then that also kind of expands the age range that you're talking about. Even though older brothers and sisters did love coming with their siblings to the sand gardens, it really was for kind of a nursery idea for younger children. But then these other elements really expanded and broadened the scope of who was welcome in a place that was only beginning then to be called a playground. Mm-hmm. So the word is just coming into use.
Well, Ruth, what seems to me, though, is that the idea of a play space or playgrounds really goes through several evolutions. I mean, most of us in this day and age are familiar with those, the primary colors, the plastic, the toddler-safe sort of bucket swings, that kind of thing. But what you're describing is absolutely nothing like that. I mean, give me the quick sort of outline of two other major evolutions in terms of how we came to the kinds of playgrounds we're familiar with today.
Yeah, so that sort of bucket seat primary color that's been sort of dismissively called the McDonald's model.
Right.
There's sort of a backlash to that now. But if you go back to the early years of that, you know, the first outdoor equipment, if you look at photos, it's really kind of shocking how that's these sky-high metal, metal swings, metal slides, jungle gyms. It's really kind of, it's shocking to imagine kids playing on them, even though you know they did. So there's this period of real, very dramatic equipment. As the 20th century progresses, things are getting, there's a little bit more sort of conformity and safety, a period of real creativity in the middle of the century. The Museum of Modern Art in New York hosted a playground design competition in the mid-50s that spawned a lot of creativity. And you're also getting these interesting sort of, there are things like rocket ships and these sort of space age designs in the 60s. And then in the 70s, there's a couple of high-profile lawsuits, high-profile injuries, and those are, you know, very real and very legitimate. None of this should be meant to sort of dismiss these sort of basic safety concerns. But you do have consumer advocates publicizing some of these risks. And the Consumer Product Safety Commission is issuing guidelines in the late 70s and early 80s. And that's where some of this older kind of, you know, wackier and more dangerous equipment starts to get phased out over the course mm-hmm. of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And we end up with this McDonald's model with, their guide, it's a safety, I would say a safety obsession that might be
yeah.
a little bit too strong.
Well, in a minute, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that because mm-hmm. full disclosure, speaking to the mother of a 3.5-year-old mm-hmm. who's got a lot of experience at these type of playgrounds, and I'll ask you about that in just a moment. But listeners, we're talking about the evolution of the American playground, which had its start here in Boston in 1885, and is now these old-fashioned type natural playgrounds seem to be having a resurgence as well. I'm speaking with Paige Johnson. She's a Tulsa-based playground expert and is curating an exhibit on playground design for the Boston Design Museum that will open next year. And with Ruth Graham, who's a frequent contributor to the Boston Globe's ideas section. She recently wrote an article for the Globe called How the American Playground Was Born in Boston. And listeners, we know that a lot of you might have some experience with this, so we want to hear from you. What are your favorite playgrounds in the Boston area? If you've been one of the newer natural playgrounds that we talked about a little earlier in the introduction to this segment, how do your kids react when they're there? What do they do that they might not do at conventional play spaces? And in a minute or two, we're going to hear a bit about a European playground where kids can do backflips on mattresses and set fires with impunity, all in the name of unstructured creativity and constructive risk-taking. So what do you make of that? Can we take this concept too far? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So Paige, let me turn back to you before we get to this kind of extreme playground that I hinted at in these questions. I do want to ask you about the safety issue, because in these newer natural playgrounds, which have, you know, wood and water and grass mm-hmm. and looser objects, essentially, mm-hmm. I look at them and at first I just fall in love with them. I love the concept. But at the same time, as I told you, you know, when I take my daughter to a regular playground, she's 3.5, she loves to climb, and I try to let her do everything that she wants to do, but my heart is constantly in my throat. So how do you get a sense of, how do you take care of the question of safety?
Well, I think it's certainly a challenge to balance all these factors in the creation of a playground that is a public space that anybody's going to come to and use, and there are certain risks associated with that. I think in balance with the or in with also with the concern of safety, we also have just a concern of ease of maintenance on the part of municipalities. And sometimes natural features are viewed as just being difficult to maintain. If a child takes some of the wood blocks home with them, they're going to have to be replaced. At the Alexander Kemp Playground out in Cambridge, they originally had some kind of large wooden blocks that were left there on the playground for the children to construct with. And then other mothers complained that the children started throwing them. So it's certainly something that we have to balance. But I think what we need to do in the playground conversation in the United States is to really turn to a conversation that is about both risk and benefit. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, for many years, the only thing mentioned has been playground risk. And so if you only talk about risk, even the smallest risk is too much. But if you talk about, okay, we have these loose parts here, there is a risk that a child will throw them at another child, but there are some great benefits to playing to those. And do those benefits outweigh, those large developmental benefits outweigh the small risk that these materials would be misused?
Right.
And not just for natural playgrounds, but really for all sorts of playgrounds across the United States, whether that's adventure playgrounds, whether that's traditional playgrounds, whether that's kind of highly stylized avant-garde designed playgrounds. We need to be having a conversation that is about both risk and benefit.
Yeah, so on that point, you mentioned the Kemp Playground in Cambridge Common, which is, it's got wonderful sort of wooden structures and sculptures in it that are both beautiful to look at and fun to play on.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the program, we mentioned the Spark Center in Mattapan, and we have a little bit more tape here from Tamar Warburg, who was one of the architects who helped design the natural playground and outdoor space at the Spark Center. And to give listeners a bit better sense as to what this particular playground looks like, she described the landscape of the park to us.
Let me give you an example. This rock here, we uncovered after we took out all the garbage that was on the site. And it was standing about 3 feet high. So we sloped up the earth to get to it and kind of made a stepping intermediate kind of soft landing place below it. So you think like a kid, okay, how can I get into trouble? And then you make sure that it's safe.
So Tamar Warburg there describing both incorporating natural elements and safety into a new playground. Ruth Graham, is that sort of how these new play spaces are being done?
Yeah, I love that idea. And I think that's one of the big benefits of these natural playgrounds. So you have slides sort of built into hills where kids can still get the experience of the feeling of a high slide, the thrills of, you know, when you look back at those early 20th century photos of these terrifyingly perilous slides, kids can still get that sort of height, but without the risk of the fall, so of a long fall. So yeah, that's one of the great advantages of these natural playgrounds.
I was really glad to hear Tamara mention the word landscape. One of the failings
right.
of playgrounds in the 80s and 90s were that they essentially weren't landscapes. They were flat deserts on which we installed a big piece of equipment. And this move to make a playground a proper landscape is really important to having a place that both the child and the parent feel engaged and that they want to revisit. That they want to come back to.
Well, how far can we take this concept? Because we were reading an article in The Atlantic by Hannah Rosen, and she visited a play space in Wales, I believe it's called The Land, that essentially looks like a junkyard, right? I mean, it's got old mattresses, it's got a rope swing over a creek that, you know, if you're not strong enough to swing the whole way, you can end up in the creek. It's got old chairs. I mean, it really looks like a junkyard. And I meant it when she was talking about seeing children set fire to things, and that was okay. There are professional minders there, but at first blush, it seems like the kind of space where we could not ever imagine having in the United States.
There are a couple in the United States. I think they're both in California, and it's never really taken off here. I think for sort of obvious reasons, the risks and also just the appearance. I mean, they look really, they look like junkyards, which is, you can imagine being really, really exciting for kids, but less exciting for parents to sort of see that in the middle of their well-manicured neighborhoods.
So. Uh-huh.
Yeah, this is kind of the extreme end of playgrounds, full-on anarchy, and the anarchy of the child, allowing them really just to do wherever they want, whatever they want. But it is quite common in Europe, actually. The idea of the junk playground was born out of the rubble-strewn vacant lots that were left after bombings in World War II. And people noticed that the children were just playing happily in these lots and amusing themselves on their own with what looked like junk. And there was the idea, well, maybe we should just provide places like this. And so though they have a kind of a strong cultural history in Europe, they never really made it in the States. And it's significant that the only ones that we have here in the States are in Berkeley, which is a place you would kind of expect an anarchic sort of space to arise. And as Ruth said, in other spaces, one, they look messy and people aren't comfortable with that. They feel risky. The fire is there, that sort of thing, and people aren't comfortable with that. But also in the United States, we don't really have a tradition of paying what are called play workers to supervise children on place in play spaces. And that is hard enough for people to keep supporting in Europe in a time when budgets are low. But we really don't have never had that cultural tradition. I think there's some hope for adventure playgrounds taking off here that perhaps are privately funded or privately supported by a school or a neighborhood or an organization. But I think that's really the place that they're going to fit rather than in municipalities. And so I think we should focus on making the playgrounds that we have here more adventurous.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I do want to take a quick call because we've got some callers who want to join us. So let's turn to Nate, who's calling from Framingham. You're on the air, Nate.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing well. What's your thought today?
Well, I'm one of the horticulturalists at Garden in the Woods out in Framingham, and it's a public garden. And we last year just installed like an interactive children's garden that is kind of like a hybridization between a playground and kind of a like an exploratory learning situation. And just in general, public gardens all across the nation have been installing these gardens that are building in all kinds of programming with local schools and giving kids an opportunity to play and learn at the same time. And I just felt like that was maybe worth mentioning.
Great, Nate. Thank you so much for your call. Ruth Graham, you actually made a touch upon this point in your piece in the Globe Ideas section that these spaces shouldn't necessarily be limited to children-only spaces. That why not incorporate these concepts into more public spaces?
Yeah, exactly. And I have to say, I sort of got this idea from Paige to give credit where credit's due. But the idea that spaces for play don't have to be sort of proper playgrounds. So there are interactive works of art. When you think of the Bean in Chicago, which I thought was a great example of this, where you that big sort of shiny sculpture in Millennium Park that whole families interact with and play with, even though no one would formally call that a playground.
Right.
Well, that's one of the great things we're seeing in play at the present moment is kind of the expansion of what we define as a space for play. It's great that we have traditional playgrounds, and we should, but the child really should be welcome to play at most sites throughout the city.
Yeah. You know, I do think we should spend a minute or two talking about what the perceived benefits of these different types of playgrounds are. And in order to do so, I just want to return to a little bit of tape that we got from the Spark Center, again, in Mattapan. It's a child care program that has a natural playground. We actually spoke to them a couple years ago. That playground is still there. It's vibrant. It's going strong. And the kids love it. But when we talked to Dana Hoyt, who's a teacher there on opening day back in 2010, she really underscored to us how their natural playground differs from traditional urban playgrounds that these children most often encountered.
Our other traditional playground, they run around in circles, they play on the bike, they go down the slide. Out here, they make a lot of their own decisions about where they're going, what they're doing. They're a lot more creative in the way they play.
So Paige, talk to us about that, because that seems to be the underlying difference that people say you get with these new / old-fashioned design playgrounds, that kids just play differently and they're getting different benefits out of it.
One of the strongest criticisms of the McDonald's style playground, to use a cliche, that's often called in Europe KFC for kit, fence, and carpet. One of the strongest arguments against that is kids actually line up and they go through a defined pathway through the playground. And there's only so many pathways you can take. And it really kind of represents almost an institutionalized form of play or design of play. And in these other sorts of playgrounds, whether that's natural playgrounds or other sorts of playgrounds that allow it, you have a concept of infinite play, where the children aren't on a specific path that they are forced into by the equipment, but they're on their own path through the playscape, whether that's going up and down a hill, whether that's putting sand in a pail and pouring it out multiple times, perhaps moving tree limbs from one place to another and creating a den. But they play much longer, and that's really critical. In the conversation about childhood obesity, one of the issues is that a child really needs to play vigorously for about 20 minutes to receive any physical benefit. And if the playground isn't engaging them to do that, then it's really kind of failing in its job.
Right, or if they're not even breaking a sweat, right?
Exactly.
Because they're just going up and down the same slide over and over again.
Right.
Ruth Graham, tell us, it does seem that there are quite a few more of these types of play spaces in the greater Boston area than we've seen before. But do we have a sense that more and more communities in Massachusetts, for example, are embracing the concept?
You know, I hope so. It's a little hard. You know, I don't have numbers in front of me on that, but it certainly feels like, I mean, you refer to that Hannah Rosen story in The Atlantic. There's certainly this moment of a backlash against the sort of dull McDonald's model. So I think it starts in the most sort of progressive communities that have the most resources to install things like this. But it's certainly an idea that's spreading. So I can't speak to that with definitive numbers, but it does seem like this is the way of the future.
And Paige Johnson, in the last couple seconds, literally, that we have here, I mean, for people listening who might be interested in bringing this kind of play space into their community, what's the first thing you might advise them to do?
Well, I would advise them to be engaged with the existing places for play. One of the great things about natural elements is they can be added to an existing playground. You can make a sand pit. You can add some rocks. You can add some tree stumps. You can form a grassy hill so that the playground is not flat. So be engaged with the existing places for play and making them better through the use of these new techniques.
Well, Paige Johnson is a Tulsa, Oklahoma-based playground expert. She's curating an exhibit on playground design for the Boston Design Museum that will open next year. Paige, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Ruth Graham, joining us today from Concord, New Hampshire, is a contributor to the Boston Globe's Ideas section. She wrote an article on the history of the American playground. Ruth, great to have you as always.
Thank you.
And we'll go out of this segment here with a little more singing from the Spark Playground in Mattapan. There's more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.